for a lot of people that have grown up in the wrestling business, I'm sure they're very well aware of your book. You know, Every Man Has His Price. So that tells a big chunk of your story. So what was the origin of this film, and why did you feel the need to tell the story that way?
Well, you know, I'm a minister, and I have been for 17 years, and I kind of call it a God thing. It's the way this whole thing happened. Mm-hmm. I was approached several years ago by Peter Fierro, who directed this, who put this whole thing together. But I was approached by him. He was doing a favor for a friend and simply doing what we call in our industry a shoot interview. In other words, mm-hmm. we're not talking about wrestling storylines. We're talking about real life. Well, you start asking me questions about my real life, I'm going to start telling you about what Jesus has done in it. And in Pete's own words at the time, he was the backslidden son of a minister. And my story resonated with him. And we became friends, developed a relationship, and he lives in New Jersey, in the New York area, and on a couple different occasions when I would come to town and speak at a church, he would come, and he just approached me one day and said, you know, I would like to tell your story in film. And so I was like, well, okay. And then my son came along and added a little twist to it and said, Dad, how about we do this? It's your story, but as seen through my eyes. I said, wow, okay. That is different. And it's amazing because, I've told this story. I mean, I wrote that book, I mean, like in 1994, I believe.
Yeah.
And I've been telling the story for 17 years, and yet now all of a sudden, and I never dreamed in my wildest imagination that we would do a film and that it would then be a Fathom event seen in,
sure.
you know, 650 to 700 theaters across the country, which is pretty remarkable. But that's kind of, you know, it's kind of how it came to be, is that it was a suggestion of Pete. And so here we are 17 years later, and I'm still telling this story. And it's funny, a very close evangelist friend of mine, he said to me years ago, he said, Ted, he says, never tire of telling your story. He says, it's your calling card.
Wow.
And, and he was right. I've traveled all over the United States, Canada. I've been to the Philippines once and to India three times and all over Europe. And yet I'm still telling the story. For about 6 years, between 2006 and 2012, I did a lot of speaking for an organization in Canada called Promise Keepers Canada. Mm-hmm. Now, it's the same mission statement as Promise Keepers in the USA, but it's a totally different entity. And so I would go up there and probably do 5, 6, sometimes 7 Promise Keepers events around the country a year. But the spinoff of that was, at each one of those events, there'd be probably 10 to 12, 15 churches represented, and a lot of those pastors would then call me
wow.
to come back up to Canada mm-hmm. and speak at their churches. So it's just been an ongoing thing. And so obviously God's not through with me. I'm going to keep telling the story. I mean, I know already there are a couple of major men's events that have been slated that I'll be speaking at. You know, after the viewing, and I know that we're looking at releasing it in DVD, and there's even talk of another book. So,
wow,
you never know. Mm-hmm. You never know.
So, let me ask you: how do you think your story changes because it's told through the eyes of your son?
It's just that father-son. Connection. It's back when the tension started when I've told the story so many times, you know, but I got caught up in it. I got caught up in the lifestyle, the whole deal, and mm-hmm. love my wife, love my children, but, you know, I was a guy on the road constantly, and I caved, and, you know, and then when I was caught in adultery, it was like, oh my gosh. And it was like, almost instantaneously, I was like, in my mind, I said, you fool.
Wow.
You have put at risk the most valuable things in your life, and for what? And I didn't have an unhappy life. I had a great wife and great kids, and I was just selfish. And it was, I was filling a void, and those, you know, the price of fame. And I also want to say this, the price of fame is whatever you make it. I mean, because we all are the sum total of the choices we make. And, you know, there are ways to safeguard yourself against things of this nature. But, you know, if those things aren't in place, and in my life at the time, they weren't. And
mm-hmm.
so, but my wife said to me, she said, even though you have done this to me, you're a great dad.
Wow.
Even though you travel so much and you're gone a lot, you are so totally engaged with your boys when you're home, and they always know. Even if you're not there on the day of a game, you call them. She said so. Until they're old enough to understand this, they don't know it. And I said, okay.
Wow.
And it was never really spoken of. And then when I actually started speaking to churches and sharing it, and they were old enough to go to the, you know, churches and hear me, you know, share the story, and I just waited. It's like, if, you know, if they have any more questions, then they'll come ask me.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until we did this that had, it's kind of sparked that. And, but it's done nothing but strengthen our relationship.
Yeah.
Cause it's kind of like my boys, and you see it in the film, you know, they know, cause they've never known us not to be in love with each other. They've never, cause they never saw a lot of fighting. They never saw anything like that.
Yeah.
So it's like, then Dad, how could you do this? You know, and it's like I said in the film, you know, it's like being two different people. And, you know, and I look back at that and I go, who was that guy?
Wow.
Because I don't recognize him anymore.
A couple of years ago, I interviewed Bob Backlund, and he's been married, you know, just as long as you have. And I said to him, that's very unheard of in professional wrestling. Like, how did that happen? And he said, my wife's never seen me perform live. And she won't. So, like, is that kind of like your advice in a way, like to separate your character from the person that you are outside, and to make them very separate?
Well, I mean, my wife was never around the business much. Only maybe special events,
mm-hmm.
maybe three or four times. I mean, it's like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, who else takes their wife to work with them? You know?
Yeah.
And, so there was always that separation, and I didn't want her to be around it anyway.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, people say, well, did you actually become that character? And I go, no, I mean, you know, no, I didn't berate people. I didn't, you know, I was not the full-hearted million-dollar man, you know,
mm-hmm.
But what I was a guy who was all into himself for sure. My wife would tell me when I would come home off the road that, she said she could see that, like, you know, it's almost like I've got my guard up all the time.
Wow.
And she says we would get about a 20 minute drive from the airport to home. And she says I could actually see your shoulders relax and you just stop being that guy. And, it's funny. It's hard to explain, really, but I know I wasn't, you know, it's like, it's funny. When I was going into a building and coming out of a building, and if it was directly related to wrestling, I was the million-dollar man,
mm-hmm.
but I'd go, you know, it's funny. I some of the same kids that, would cuss at me, spit at me and flip me the bird when I was walking into and out of the building, you know, an hour later, they're in the hotel lobby because they found out where all the guys are staying.
Oh, yeah.
And they're wanting your autograph. Mm-hmm. The same kids.
Absolutely.
And so, and I would do it. So it wasn't, you know, it was, but it was still an ego trip. It was still, more than anything, I think, filling a void. You know, it's kind of like people, and again, fame. Wow, you know, people think about fame. They think about seeing you in this arena, and man, how would it feel to be in an arena and everybody knows your name and knows who you are, and they're, you know, you're screaming for you or booing you like they did me. Wow, how powerful that is. But what the people don't see is when you leave that arena and you go back to your hotel room and you're staring at four walls and a television and your family's 200 or 2,000 miles away, they're not there. And then you do that night after night after night, you know, and it gets to be a lonely place. And, you know, you go down to the bar and you have a beer and it turns into two and then it's three and da-da-da-da-da-da, down the road you go. And that's how those things happen. And, you know, you're filling the void. It's almost like you become a different person, or just you ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, right?
Yeah.
Well, or what happens on the road stays on the road. Well, that's not reality. Eventually, it's going to catch up to you.
Sure. So, considering everything that you just told me, this is kind of like a two-parter. How did you feel when your son told you that he wanted to be a wrestler, and how did you prepare him for all of this?
Well, you know, when he told me he wanted to be a wrestler, number one, I was shocked. Because he had, you know, he had graduated from college, had a degree in business administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told me he wants to wrestle. I said, well, Dad, you've always been my hero. I've always wanted to be just like you. And it's like, son, have you heard my story? And he says, of course, Dad. But here's what I realized. I realized, number one, there are some things, no matter how much you preach it to your kids, they don't get it. They don't get it because they've not experienced it and they don't understand it. So here's what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to drive a wedge in my relationship with my son. I didn't want him to go through the rest of his life thinking, well, you know, I could have done this. And Dad said no. Or then he just, you know, go against me and we have a big fight. So I said, okay. And it's kind of like, and I tell people, God basically does the same thing to us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've given you the rule book, but you want to go do it your way. You go do it your way and I'll be here when you get back. And so, yeah, I was concerned for my son and he dealt with some drinking and issues of that kind, but he wasn't, you know, the business had changed a lot and I thought that would help, and to a big degree it had, because a lot of the accountability standards that the WWE has now weren't in place when we were doing this.
Sure.
Today, they work 4 days a week. You know, they're out on the weekends, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, or Monday, Tuesday. And then they go home. Every week, they go home.
Mm-hmm.
So, plus they have a state-of-the-art drug testing policy. I mean, my son told me, he said, Dad, he says, they're so strict now. He says, let's say I get a cold or something, I go to the doctor and he prescribes me an antibiotic or something. He says, the first thing I have to do is call the WWE doctor.
Wow.
And let him know what's been prescribed, because if it shows up in my system and I haven't told him about it, even if it's not a cocaine or some illicit drug,
mm-hmm.
then I'm still docked. I'm still on vacation for 30 days.
Wow.
So they've improved a lot of things in WWE that, you know, helps that accountability that wasn't there when I was there. But even with that, my son figured it out. I mean, I said, you're to be a star in this business, it's going to consume so much of your time that it will be your family. And even with having the days off, he realized, oh my gosh, I'm gone all the time. And he says, that's not fair to my wife and my son. And I was like, you know, and he called me and told me when his contract was about to expire. He said, Dad, he says, the first thing is I don't want to hear those words. And I said, what words? I told you so. and I said, okay, I won't say those words. Now what's up? And he says, well, my contract's coming up and I'm not going to re-up. And he was doing great. I mean, he was doing really good.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why? I said, well, basically you were right. And so he figured it out on his own. And, today I have no children that are wrestlers and I couldn't be happier. And again, I loved what I did. And, you know, and I don't want to discourage anybody out there that if that's your dream, go for it. And the only thing I would say is, it's like, you know, if that's what you want to do, stay single until you're out of it because it's going to be your life.
Yeah.
And it's just the nature of the beast. It's not anybody's fault.
Mm-hmm. So you've done so much in professional wrestling, but is there like one or two things that you say it would have been really cool to have done that?
Yeah, you know, not really. I think because I had a really good run. You know, I mean, one question I think I did an interview with somebody and asked, is there somebody who you never wrestled that you wish you could have? And I said, yeah, there's probably a couple, but one guy, his name was Jack Briscoe. Jack Briscoe was, NWA World Heavyweight Champion.
Yeah, magician.
Some of the greatest matches I ever saw were between him and Dory Funk Jr. and mm-hmm. Terry Funk. Now, I've been in the ring with both of the Funks. I mean, Terry's like a brother more mm-hmm. than a friend. That's just our relationship. And my family's relationship goes all the way back to our dads. And, but Jack Briscoe is one of those guys who I knew him. I've been in the ring with his brother, Jerry. But I never had a chance to wrestle Jack. And I wish I could have.
Wow. So I have to ask you, Friday I was fortunate enough to see you at the WrestlePro event and, you were talking in the ring, you were plugging the film. But then you shocked me because you put Sean Donovan in the Million Dollar Dream, and then you Russian leg sweeped him, perfect flat back bump. Was that planned? Have you been doing that like the entire time that you've been on the road? Like, what was the thought process behind that? Because I mean, you're 63, you keep yourself in good shape, but that was a real deal bump, man, and it was perfect.
Well, you know, it's like riding a bike, you know, you never forget. And I do it occasionally. Uh-huh. And I tell the promoter, I said, you know, cause they want to do something. They want to see something. And I have done it where I just, I block a punch and hit him and he staggers up. I put him in the dream and I lay him down. But, I only take the bump if I know the ring is really good.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, because like I said, man, it was absolutely perfect. I ended up taping it because I was working hard cam that night, and I had my iPhone, so I got to see it in two different angles. And I'm like, this son of a gun, perfect. It was pretty crazy. So I do this thing whenever I interview somebody. I've done it with Jim Ross, Jeff Jarrett, a bunch of guys. It's like five guys. I mentioned like five wrestlers, then you tell me, and it's not like a shoot or anything, but just like five guys, and you tell me like how they affected you and your career. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Okay. So let's start off first with Mike Rotundo.
Mike Rotundo is one of the nicest guys I've ever met, and when we became tag team partners, it was probably one of the most pleasant runs I've ever had with a partner. Always on time, always professional, no worries, and not a carouser, nothing. It was just, and as a matter of fact, Mike and I are going to be together I don't think we've ever done this before, but me, Mike, and actually Jimmy Hart, mm-hmm. we're going to be signing autographs together at wow. the big event mm-hmm. in Queens on November 4th.
Nice.
Which is just before the documentary. I'm really looking forward to it. Great guy, you know, and we worked well together. We had good chemistry in the ring.
Okay. Junkyard Dog.
JYD, one of my best buddies. Mm-hmm. Bill Watts was brilliant, in my opinion, one of the best guys and had the best understanding of the psychology of our business of anybody that I've ever been promoted by. And mm-hmm. The first guy to make his top star a black man. And boy, what a great thing it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny because JYD and I were both baby faces and we got to be such good friends. We traveled together a lot. So Ernie Land says to me, Ted, because he was the booker at mm-hmm. the time this happened. He says, we need a new heel. We need somebody for you and Dog. And I used to tease Dog. I used to say, man, you know what? You roll that wheelbarrow out there and you shake your hiney a little bit and you howl like at the moon and you get in the ring and the match is over in 5 minutes and you're making all the money. And he was the best. He had so much charisma and he was so good on the microphone. He just hit me and I went back to Ernie, about a week later, and I said, I found your heel. And he goes, who? And I said, you're looking at him. And his eyes got big, and he just went, that's brilliant. And that's how it started. So we had an incredible run. But, I mean, he's a guy who I'll never forget, who I had a lot of fun with, and who I've made a lot of money with. And, he was a special enough guy that when Melanie and I got married, he was my best man.
Yep, I remember I read the book.
yeah. So, yeah, great guy.
Scott Steiner.
Scott Steiner. I was just with Scott and Rick this last weekend at a show. And, Scott's a funny guy. I mean, unbelievable athlete. How do you say wired real tight?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's got like, if he likes you, it's great. And if he doesn't like you, then you need to stay out of his way. And thank goodness we got along together pretty well.
There you go. Bobby the Brain Heenan.
The best guy on the microphone ever. Best manager. When I first met Bobby, I was wrestling in St. Louis and, I liked him then and I liked him from the first time I ever met him. And I don't know if people know, but Bobby Heenan was just as funny in real life as he was in front of the camera. He had this quick wit and just a great guy. And the thing, I tell you what I really admire about Bobby was that after this horrible thing, cancer and having to lose his lower jaw. And that was it. That his gift was his mouth. His livelihood was his ability to speak and do what he did. And now that's taken from him, but it isn't changing. He was still, every time I was around him, an autograph signer or whatever it was, he was still the same Bobby. He was still just as funny, just as witty. And it's like, he didn't fold up his sails and go off and sulk. He just kept on living. And I couldn't admire him more for that.
Excellent. And lastly, Eric Bischoff.
Eric Bischoff. Well, it's a kind of a funny relationship, I guess. Eric hired me to be, the mouthpiece of the NWO.
Mm-hmm.
And then as he saw that the NWO was getting over, he decided to interject himself into that role. And, cause I remember I just kind of noticed that, for 2 or 3 weeks there where I was going out and I'm just kind of standing in the corner you know, holding one of the belts, you know, and I just got him off to the side, told him, I said, Eric, I said, look, I said, you hired me to be the mouthpiece, and it seems to be that you're, you know, you've decided that you want that role. I said, hey, that's okay. If that's what you want to do, fine. But I didn't spend, you know, 19 years, you know, of my career building a career to end up being basically Virgil.
Yeah.
And just standing out there like a clown, not saying, and not having anything to say. And I said, so if that's what you want, then send me home because you have to pay me anyway. That was the contract.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did. And then when he brought me back, as a babyface manager for the Steiners. And a lot of that was, you know, I kind of saw that, but I mean, you know, they were, I was starting to make appearances on Christian television, sharing my story on Christian television and things of that nature. And that might've had something to do with it, but I just don't know if that was the best thing to do. So, you know, I don't know. It was, I don't know, you know, I didn't know him, but everybody said, well, he sold me out of a truck in Minneapolis. And I said, what? You know, and so, and I don't know. I don't understand. I've never understood, you know, with no more credentials than Eric had, how he got that job.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's a pretty good talker, but, you know, when I see him, I'm cordial, say hello, and I'm nice, you know, but there was one night when I think he said something to the effect that this was when the NWO was really hot, and the real battle was between the two companies, and that's why the ratings were so high every week. We were competing with Monday Night Football. And he says, he's going to run Vince McMahon out of the business, you know, and I looked at him, I said, Eric, no way. it ain't happening, buddy. It's just not going to happen. I was kind of like put off of that because, you know, I know how tenacious Vince is.
Sure.
So anyway, so I, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I'm not a guy who holds a grudge.
Sure.
You know, it would have been different if it had affected my pay, but it didn't. You know, I was, you know, it was the first time in my life I was on a real guarantee.
Yeah.
And so, it was all right. Comparing the two now, you know, it's like, Eric's obviously not a great director. He never really, because most all the guys that were stars for him those stars were created by Vince.
Mm-hmm.
And they went over. So it's not like he created any, you know, the only one he could probably take credit for would be Goldberg.
All right. Last question. Considering the fact that, like, you know, your book is considered like must read for wrestling fans. And like you said, you've spoken for years about this. What makes this film a must see for wrestling fans and for people that don't know so much about you?
Well, you know, here's my thing. You're gonna get some inside. You're gonna get it raw. It's, you know, I pour out my soul. I'm an open book. There are interviews with several of my contemporaries, Terry Funk, Harley Race. God bless him, George Animal Steel, Roddy Piper, Jake Roberts, several people that are interviewed in there that will give it their insight as far as who I was. But here's what I want, and here's what I hope people will walk away from this with. And whether you're a person of faith or not, I hope that you can see this. The real happiness in life It doesn't come from being rich. It doesn't come from being famous. It doesn't come from having a bunch of stuff, big cars and all that stuff. All those things are temporary. And what they won't ever give you is long-lasting peace and joy in your life. The only thing that does that, as far as I'm concerned, is family. And there are things, you know, $1 million man says everybody's got a price. You know, and everything does seem to have a price. But there's some things in life that are priceless. And I've been asked, Ted, are you really a multimillionaire? And I go, nope. I said, but let me tell you what I have that you can't put a price on. Today I have the respect of my wife. I have the love and respect of my sons. And I have the unbelievable privilege and joy of watching my grandchildren grow up. And one day I'm going to die. And I don't want to be simply remembered as a wrestling legend and a Hall of Famer. I much rather want to be remembered for someone who left a lasting legacy to his children and his grandchildren. That I was a man of character, a man of integrity, someone who in his later life very happily wanted to give of himself rather than keep getting, and to give back, to contribute. And that's what I'm hoping that people will take away from this, and forgiveness. I'm somebody who received grace and forgiveness, and it was a struggle. It was a struggle for my wife too. I mean, she'll tell you, she goes, I was no hero. I didn't want to do the right thing. You know, but it was the right thing because we're instructed to forgive as we're forgiven. But because she was willing to give me that chance, I took it and I ran with it. And it's hope. You know, I want people who are in those tough situations to realize nothing's hopeless. Nothing.